Nothing could be saved in the year 1150. Great Saint Martin and parts of the city had fallen victim to a great fire. The monastery church here directly on the Rhine was so badly devastated that it would have to be rebuilt. Stunned, the survivors stared at the tragedy that had taken place here. First a severe winter, floods and a bad harvest, and now this massive fire in the city. The last year had not been merciful for the people of Cologne. But from the ashes of Great Saint Martin, a golden century of Romanesque architecture would take place in the city, beginning here in 1150. Or as the famous art historian Werner Meyer Barkhausen called it, the Great Century of Cologne Church Architecture. We'll hear what that means and how it still dominates Cologne today in a moment. And at the end, we'll answer the question, what did a construction site actually look like at that time? What were the working conditions here? All this right after the intro. Between 1150 and 1250, numerous reconstructions and especially new buildings of monastery and collegiate churches took place in Cologne. Great Saint Martin, victim of the fire of 1150, was rebuilt, however, continued to use the foundation walls of the late antique Roman warehouse. Saint Andrew's was also rebuilt not far from the cathedral, the monastery church that Archbishop Bruno once had built here. And one of the first churches we ever discussed here on the podcast, St. Cunibert, was also new built. Other monastery churches were rebuilt and expanded, like St. Geryon and St. Severin, whose core buildings date back to late antiquity. St. Mary in the capital and St. George now had stone vaulted ceilings instead of the previous wooden flat roof. St. Pantaleon, the burial place of Theophanu and Bruno, was given additional aisles. St. Cecilia was expanded into a three-nave pillar basilica, and St. Apostles was extensively extended and rebuilt, including the characteristic cloverleaf choir, which is clearly visible from Montmartre Square up until today. Ah yes, and there's the Church of St. Mary Liskirchen, a church in the former southern suburb of Oversburg, but I never quite knew how to incorporate this small church into the plot here in the podcast. Not far from where the Chocolate Museum is today in Cologne. That is now corrected. The church is documented for the first time for the year 948. It is located south in the former suburb of Oversburg, directly on the Rhine. In contrast to the other churches mentioned here, it was already a parish church at that time, not a monastery church. It was probably founded by a man named Lisolf, hence in German, Lisolfkirch. So, Lisolf Church. And after some time, the two words were abbreviated to Lyskirchen, so Lys Church. The ceiling paintings here, unlike most other churches in Cologne, have survived the ravages of time and especially the Second World War. They are beautiful to look at. Fans of art history should not miss this. All these church buildings have since then largely their external experience as today. Despite the severe destruction and because of the extensive reconstruction work, some of which took decades after 1945. I will provide numerous, even a ton of pictures on my homepage, since this is an architectural episode. I can therefore only recommend the blog entry for this episode to you on thehistoryofcologne.com. But let's first get the basics right. What is the Romanesque period anyway? And why do people build new or larger churches in that period at all? Why build so large and comprehensive? A church is at that time the place where worship takes place, meeting house of the faithful. Here the secular and the ecclesiastical are united, the temporal and the eternal, the hinge between earthly and heavenly. Another reason, pilgrimages are on the rise. People go on journeys, both regionally but also internationally, to pray for the salvation of their souls. In the places where it was hoped that the salvation of the saints in the form of their bones or objects associated with them blessed them. The number of pilgrims at that time should not be underestimated. Even the smallest villages, but which could prove an important relic in the chapel, turned into real cities at certain times or festivals of the year due to the influx of visitors, as with, for example, music festivals in the countryside. But this was also true of Cologne. This necessitated a fundamental architectural redesign and partial new construction of the corresponding church buildings in the city. Why the construction boom was economically possible? We continue in Central Europe to have a prolonged warm climate period. Agricultural surpluses and better farming methods lead to surpluses that allow capacity in crafts and trades. That is, it takes proportionally fewer people and work in agriculture to feed a larger amount of people at the same time. Cities can become more self-sufficient in this way. So the basis is created for intensive church building. How does the Romanesque architectural style express itself visually? A stylistic element of the Romanesque style are the heavy and massive exterior walls made of stone. Inside, the walls are also massive. Between the nave and the side aisles, the massive walls were broken by bridge arches set on round columns or in angular pillars, so that one can pass between the central nave and the side nave. Only small windows can be seen in the outer wall, which are rounded in an arch towards the top, a so-called round arch. Do not worry, to all these architectural terms, I have packed pictures on the homepage, thehistoryofcologne.com. Another style element is that the ceilings are often vaulted. Before that, people had usually been content with a simple flat roof made of wood. Romanesque churches that were built before the century of Cologne Romanesque are often adapted to this later. St. George in Oversburg or St. Mary in the capital near Heumarkt Square both received new stone ceiling vaults. If you want to know what such a flat wooden ceiling looked like in a Romanesque church, you can still do so today in St. Pantaleon. At the time of this episode, however, in July 2023, St. Pantaleon is closed for extensive renovation work. The Romanesque style of church buildings is a further development of the previously simpler pre-Romanesque architecture. One now builds double towers that protrude far above the rest of the building. Crossing towers are also built, usually in the middle of the building, to put it simply for you guys. Also, one builds in an intermediate level a kind of circulation through the interior of the church building along the walls, a so-called triforium. This was later also adopted from Gothic cathedrals. Anyone who has taken a guided tour of Cologne Cathedral, for example, up to the roof will also have walked along the interior triforium of Cologne Cathedral. If you think to yourself, phew, pretty tight here, it's not really much space to walk along here, it should be clear that these were originally a purely ornamental element and not supposed to be leading groups of curious thousands of tourists along here every day. The central nave is now much higher than the side naves, and of course, not to forget the vaulted ceilings. Of course, again, here the reference to my homepage, where I will try to explain all these terms with pictures. The elements that make up the Romanesque period, however, are hardly 100% to be found on today's Romanesque church buildings in Cologne. Later alterations, such in the Gothic style or the Baroque style, like Baroque interior decoration, those were often later added. The other stylistic elements have mostly been irrevocably lost, especially the interior Romanesque original decoration has been lost. That's why I had so highlighted the few remaining objects we have in Cologne from the Romanesque period, like the portal door of St. Mary in the Capitol, the crucifix from St. George, or the few remaining shrines of St. Heribert, St. Albinus, and St. Marinus. Another element that has been almost completely lost in the remaining Romanesque churches is the richly decorated interior painting, over the centuries, this was either removed so that the wall was now simply bland, or it was neglected, or if still present, it was finally destroyed during the Second World War. In Cologne, as mentioned, only St. Mary Liskirchen is a happy exception. Here too, I will try to find as much historical picture material as possible and put it on the homepage so that you can see how the Romanesque paintings inside a Romanesque church in Cologne once looked like. But nowadays, most of the time when you visit a Romanesque church in Cologne, the walls are just plain white. Before we go further into the subject, we need to clarify three things about the concept of Romanesque art and architecture. First, where does the term Romanesque come from? If you look into the contemporary historical sources, you will not find this term anywhere. Romanesque is a term that appeared only in the 19th century. So why Romanesque? Because it was a style that, in the eyes of the people from the 19th century, that had borrowed from Rome, but did not come from ancient Rome itself. In the meantime, research does not see it quite like that. It is a difficult subject, to be honest, so let's keep in mind people in the Middle Ages simply didn't know the term Romanesque. For them, it was the normal building style of their time. Nevertheless, the Romanesque style is quite real, with the stylistic elements of round arches, massive stone walls, higher central nave in comparison to other naves and aisles, and simply a higher demand for architectural specifications. The second thing we have to keep in mind, Romanesque is not only a style of architecture. It is a style that, in addition to architecture, you can also see in art, painting, or sculpture. We have already had Cologne examples of this mentioned earlier here, like the Heribert or Anno Shrine, for example, or likewise the Crucifix of St. George or the tomb slab of Plectrude in St. Mary in the capital. Or, like I said, I know, I repeat myself, the wooden gate door of St. Mary in the capital, which is still preserved today and was donated by Abbess Ida in the middle of the 11th century. Romanesque art can be versatile. Something that comes up in Romanesque art is that certain elements in paintings are disproportionately large. A person could be depicted much smaller than a saint standing next to him, or people posted fighting in an itty-bitty castle. The Romanesque period focused on the content itself, not a realistic representation. So if the castle's pretty small, but the people on it guarding it are proportionally larger, that just means the painter wanted to show you that he has the people on the wall in mind and not the castle itself. So it's not like that the painter didn't know how to use proportion. It was just not a standard that he felt dedicated to. This also goes hand in hand with the third point. Romanesque style include not only church buildings. In the same period, about 100 profane, so non-religious, houses were also built in this style, such as the homes of the rich inhabitants, jurors, Richerzeche members, and mayors wanted to live in a manner befitting their status. The rest of the population continued to live in half-timbered houses, and Jewish religious buildings were also built in this style, like the mikveh, the Jewish ritual bath in Cologne mentioned a few episodes earlier. Therefore, the question naturally arose for Cologne's wealthy class as to what their new stone houses should look like, since Romanesque church buildings were architecturally the measure of all things. They naturally built their own houses around the year 1200 in the Romanesque architectural style. Unfortunately, almost nothing is left of these 100 stone patrician houses. They have almost completely disappeared from the cityscape. Many have already been demolished over time and replaced by newer buildings. Then the destruction of the Second World War did the rest. With just one exception, but we will get to that pretty soon. Therefore, the Romanesque church buildings are almost the only thing that we can still show architecturally in Cologne from that time period, as far as this architectural style is concerned. But we still have 12 large and 16 small Romanesque churches in Cologne today, the house of the patrician family Oberstolzen, we learned about them in the last episode, is unfortunately the only secular, so non-religious, Romanesque building from that time that has survived the ravages of time. It stands in the Rheingasse street not far away from the Heumarkt, and of course, no, the Oberstolzen house is not the only one, but the Jewish mikvah building should not be forgotten as well. It still exists today. Now I have to disappoint you a little bit again. The term Romanesque century in Cologne is misleading. In Cologne, Romanesque buildings were built even before the so-called Cologne century of Romanesque art, the years 1150 to 1250. Between 1000 and 1150, a total of 28 new churches were built, both parish churches and monastery churches. Already the Cologne Cathedral from the 9th century was built in a pre-Romanesque architectural style. The beginning of this building boom before 1150 was already made in the 10th century by our hotly revered Theophano. With the extension of St. Pantaleon, she significantly influenced the style of the local Romanesque architecture with additional Byzantine style elements. But even Archbishop Bruno, Theophano's uncle, had the old Cologne Cathedral further extended in the Romanesque style with side aisles 20 years earlier. Romanesque architecture had thus existed in Cologne for some time, but around 1150 the building projects intensified. However, there was no centralized planning, it was the individual monasteries and convents themselves that did this. So there was no assembly where it was announced to start the great Romanesque century of Cologne. Things were simply good economically around Cologne at that time. Pilgrims came from all over the place, left their money in the city, trade flourished, the population increased massively, rich citizens of the city boasted of being sponsors for the new large church buildings, for prestige and for their salvation. All this favored the building boom of those 100 years between 1150 and 1250. When the smoke of the fire had cleared in 1150, the people of Cologne really started to rebuild their city. Residential buildings were rebuilt, but so were the city's church buildings. With the new construction of St. Kunibert, the Romanesque century in Cologne experiences a brilliant, but also final, finale. Thus, in the 100 years between 1150 and 1250, a very unique Cologne Romanesque style developed. Elements of it are triforiums or dwarf galleries with ring-shaped barrel vaults, with the also often built three-leaf clover choir or triconchus in the technical language. Biblical numbers are realized in stone. God is triune in Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. 3 hours of darkness prevailed until Jesus died on the cross, and after 3 days, the resurrection took place. The Cologne Romanesque style influenced a wide region in turn in its building of Romanesque architecture. Influences of the Cologne Romanesque style can be found as far south as Koblenz and Limburg an der Lahn, and as far north as today's Netherlands and Belgium. But all this talk about architecture can get tiresome, well, for me anyway. So I was very interested in the organization and construction of all the new buildings and conversions. Imagine what was going on in the streets of Cologne during those 100 years. A steady stream of building materials reached the city. Stones were unloaded at the port, and carts brought lumber to the construction sites. Numerous skilled workers, both local and from abroad, worked directly in people's daily lives and sometimes in surrounding streets. How was such a building site structured? Much of what we know about medieval church construction sites we know from the later Middle Ages, that is from the 13th century onward. But of course we can assume that even before that, before the written and also pictorial tradition in historical sources, the construction management was quite similar. Now the job titles all had either a Latin or Middle High German term, but I will always try to find a corresponding contemporary term for you. The head of a construction site was the so-called Magister Operis or Magister Fabricae, the master builder. The master builder was usually either a stonemason, a Magister Lapidae / Sculptor, or a mason, a Magister Cementarii. Guys, it has been a long time since I had Latin at university. Please be kind. Building design at that time of the Romanesque century in Cologne is so very different from today. The building drawings, so the painting and preparation of building plans, only appeared in the 13th century. The construction drawings, so the drawing and preparation of building plans, only appeared in the 13th century. The most famous of these is, of course, the so-called Ris F, one of seven preserved medieval drawings of the facade of the present-day but Gothic Cologne Cathedral. But at that time of the Romanesque century in Cologne, this did not yet exist. Nor before that, and yes, not even in antiquity in Roman times. The fact that this began in the 13th century shows that, contrary to popular opinion, the Middle Ages had their technological progress, especially in architecture. But in our time, in the middle of the 12th century, builders do not yet make architectural drawings or plans. Sometimes there were at most sketches of the entire building without any precise scale. This was drawn on parchment or roughly scratched into wax tablets, so that the client knew what was planned there as a building. What seems like a technological shortcoming from today's perspective, however, impressed me all the more, because it demanded a lot from the master builder. Building and planning was done according to the principle of opus in mente conceptum, as had already been practiced in Roman antiquity. The work built in the spirit. That's the translation of that Latin quote. Thus, we only know what the old Romanesque Cologne Cathedral looked like because it is depicted in the Hellenos Codex, so a drawing for a book cover. The exact dimensions of it, however, we know only through the archaeological excavations since the middle of the 20th century. But how did the workers on the construction site know how to build the building? How big should a door be? How wide a window? How high a round arch? In individual construction phases, full-size drawings in original size were made for individual components on wooden drawing boards or on plaster surfaces. The craftsmen then used these as a guide and made the components. Again, I have great respect for the construction work of these people from that time, without modern machines, without construction drawings, and especially without the use of comprehensive mathematics. So where did the master builder get his knowledge from? Through wandering in his younger years, which brought him to numerous construction sites all over Europe, through oral knowledge he received, and simply through experience. Often the master builder doesn't even know Latin, which is the technical and scientific language of that time, nor can he usually even read and write properly. Again, I find it unbelievable that one could erect large and mighty buildings under these circumstances, buildings destined for eternity. These master builders were often internationally renowned and well known. In 1003, for example, according to the report of Landbert of Liège, the Archbishop of Cologne, Heribert, a big friend from our show, brought three foreign master builders to Deutz to rebuild the previously collapsed abbey church. In addition to the master builder, who supervises and coordinates the management of the work, there's also a manager who manages the finances separately. This was often a person of the group of people that had initiated the rebuilding or the new building. In the case of churches and monasteries, it was someone from the ranks of the monastery, the cathedral chapter, or the convent or the parish. Now let's move on to the individual professions on a construction site. How do we know the work steps or the professions on a building site of the 12th century? Because they are often not only described in the sources, but also drawn. admittedly often only in the late Middle Ages, yes, but here it is also quite true that they also originated in the High Middle Ages or even before that. The labor force can be divided into two groups, so to speak. On the one hand, we have the skilled and well-paid artisans, in Latin, artifices or operarii, and the unskilled laborers hired as, day laborers, like servii or servants. The skilled workers consist of masons, stonemasons, sculptors, carpenters, blacksmiths, roofers, rope makers, glaziers, and at the quarry, of course, we have stone crushers. In addition, there were often lead casters, polishers, sawyers, sometimes, depending on the equipment, even marble workers. And we have also other laborers who performed heavy work, like mortarmen, cottagers who assisted the stonemasons, such as cleaning up and carrying things around, winchmen who operated cranes and were very well paid because of the heavy and dangerous work. They operated treadwheels, in which they lifted heavy loads by physical strength of their body. Thus, to this day, the treadmill proverbially stands for hard and monotonous work. And funnily enough, it's a metaphor in German and English. I just looked it up. In addition, there were numerous excavators, and I'm talking about humans with shovels, not the machines, because they did not exist, obviously, as well as helpers and porters. And so it can be seen that here on a construction site, in contrast to the countryside, where farmers try to be as self-sustainable as possible, there was a clear division of labor, which we also know from construction sites today. Medieval building sites for churches and cathedrals were places where technological progress was accomplished. The architectural style of the Romanesque period was already something that the Romans, as much as I love them, could not have built with their technological means. So much for their thesis from parts of historical science that church building was a waste of money. How many unskilled laborers or craftsmen worked at a construction site depended on the scope of the construction phase, and the time of the year. At harvest time in fall, many were not at the construction site, mostly the unskilled workers, of course. What we unfortunately do not learn, who were these people? What did they think? What were their names? How did they feel about the working conditions? They remain an unknown mass of people in the historical sources. In the crypt of St. George, however, there is a very small exception. There, a master builder carved a small inscription on a capital that is the top of a column. And here he wrote, and here we have a case where the master builder could read and write, obviously. He wrote, "Here brat me fecit." Translated from Latin into English, it means, "Here brat created me." So that was obviously the name of the master builder. It is also not known where the mostly out-of-town craftsmen slept. Did they stay in hostels? Were their own shelters built for them? We have no idea. If you look at the working hours back then, they didn't quite correspond to today's work-life balance. They worked from 5 a.m. to 7 p.m. outside of winter. In the winter, however, people also worked around 10 hours a day or a bit less if the weather did not permit it. Saturday is free from 3 p.m. as well as on days before church holidays, of which there were not a few. That could be around 30 to 41 holidays a year. It depends on the region and time. Work was mostly done in the open air. It was not until 1200 that wooden shacks or huts were added to construction sites to protect the stonemasons from the heat or rain during work. How did it look with the remuneration? As far back as our recent times, the craftsmen were paid the weekly wage on Friday or Saturday. Some skilled workers who produced per piece were paid per piece at the end of the week, as with stonemasons or carpenters, for example. Day laborers obviously, logically, received their wages daily. how much money someone got cannot be really determined for this period. Only for the late Middle Ages have I found reliable figures, but not for Cologne and especially not for the 12th century. In the case of skilled workers, almost all skilled trades involved prior training. This is also the This also is the case with today's skilled trades in Germany. Apprentices were trained by master craftsmen. Normally, an apprenticeship or training could be started at the age of 14. The training then lasted between 3 and 5 years, where the trainee was gradually introduced to the respective work steps of his job. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? If you wanted to become a master craftsman, you had to go on the road for a year and gain experience on other construction sites. In German, it is the so-called Walz. For many centuries, it was a big part of economic life in medieval Germany. The Walz became less and less important in the 20th century as it was no longer compulsory, but more recently the Walz in Germany has again celebrated a small renaissance. In comparison, the number is pretty low per year, but a few hundred wanderers are always around. In Cologne, the crafts were supervised, organized, and controlled by brotherhoods, the so-called guilds. This is a topic I have avoided so far. Why? Quite simply, I still know too little about it to present this in detail. These guilds are generally documented for the Middle Ages only from the middle of the 12th century, also for Cologne. But from the way they are mentioned in Cologne's historical sources, it becomes clear that craft guilds must have existed much longer before the first written mention. Thus, the document issued around 1149 by the Riecherzeche is considered the first evidence of a guild, since the recipients of that document are the makers of bed pillows and bed covers, the so-called in German Bettziechenweber. This cannot be the first Cologne guild at all. This craft was already very special, so it can be assumed that before that, other guilds already existed. Before it, there will be certainly longer already have existed the superior and far more powerful and bigger weaver guild, for example. The textile industry was one of the main economic sectors of the city. It can't be that they had been second behind some pillow makers. The tools of the workers remain largely the same from ancient times until well into the 19th century. Workers used trowel, hammer, plumb bob, setting level, pickaxe, lump, angle, straight edge, compass, axe, saw, paint, string, and hoe. Sorry, I'm just a foolish boy. Just to name a few of the tools. Who is initiating such construction sites? This is easy to answer in this case. In the case of a monastery, the builder was the abbot or abbess. In the case of episcopal churches / cathedrals, it was usually the bishop or even, depending on the location, the cathedral chapter. In other words, the leadership level of the clergy there at the cathedral. Although the Archbishop of Cologne resides in Cologne Cathedral, administratively, the cathedral is independent of the Archbishop and administers itself as a cathedral monastery. Until today, by the way. How do these buildings finance themselves? Above all, monasteries and convents had revenues that they received through the exercise of rights or simply through ownership, such as leasing of land or farms. Sometimes new members in the monastery / convent were obliged, as payment for admission to the monastery, to renounce the benefice to which he or she was actually entitled for the first time and thus finance the construction. The benefice is the part that a clergyman of a monastery or parish church received from the common income of the monastery / parish church. When money was scarce, the sale of property or real estate of the spiritual institution was not a taboo, or one relied on patronizing benefactors, as in the case of St. Mary in the capital, where the rich Itzonit woman Ida as abbess certainly financed the construction out of her own pocket. While Ida probably paid for the whole building, you could also do part financing, even in smaller amounts. In the case of St. Kunibert, we know from a man named Johann, so the German version of John, who together with a scholar Francis and four other persons, we don't know the names of them, donated a colored glass window for the construction site. They can be seen figuratively among the saints depicted in that colored window in miniature on the bottom. Like, for example, in the window that depicts Saint Cordula. They are literally below her, holding their hands up high to her. So one hoped, as a donor, that the corresponding saint, which you made a window for, would put in a good word for you up in heaven, and you would go to paradise after your own death, without the detour through purgatory. And then the almost most important source of income should not be forgotten for monasteries, especially. The income from the pilgrimages. Sancta Colonia, so Holy Cologne, had accumulated countless relics, a subject we must treat separately, let countless pilgrims come to Cologne. They had to pay money to get near the relics. Cologne, like Rome and Santiago de Compostela or even Jerusalem, were one of the main pilgrimage centers of Christian Europe. As far as parish churches were concerned, the financing was not entirely dissimilar. Rich inhabitants of the parish donated money or building materials for their own salvation, and maybe also so that their own parish church would look a little cooler than in the neighboring district where a guy lived you did not really like much, for example. This could sometimes, depending on the financial strength of a parish, produce extremely differently equipped parish churches. Large and magnificent parish churches like St. Columba or Little St. Martin, or more modest ones like in the former suburbs of Niederich or Oversburg. Kings and emperors, on whom the Cologne citizenry relied politically more and more as a counterweight to the archbishop as the city lord, they rarely donated. If they did, then only for the finished church. They gave money for a window or something like that. However, the exact method of financing for the period can no longer be traced, since records are missing, let alone that they were made at all. The construction methods have hardly changed since ancient times. The stone to be built is set, the alignment is checked with a plumb bob, another worker uses a straight edge for the same purpose. Thus, little by little, ashlar by ashlar is raised a wall with mortar. The builders knew statics, but no calculated statics by mathematics. Only since the 18th century has this been possible in the same way as we do today in building buildings. But this does not mean that people did not rely on statics in construction and forgot about it. Here people relied on experience and old traditions, or they tested it out before. They built separate arches, for example, and looked, how big can I build this arch before it crumbles because of its own weight? They really did that. They built several times and then they looked what worked, and then they used it at their construction sites. And what can be said against that? The preserved Romanesque church buildings in Europe are still standing today, even if the collapse of the first Abbey church in Deutz around the year 1000 showed that now and then something could go wrong, but that was rare. The present Gothic Cologne Cathedral, begun in 1248, took a very long time to build, 600 or more years. But this was by no means the rule for Romanesque churches. Large churches and cathedrals were built in comparatively short time, if money, building materials, and skilled workers were available. I find that impressive when you considered what modest means were available at the time compared to today, and when you consider that often the construction of a single large church for a city was already costly. Remember, Cologne simply times parallel quasi builds on 11 large Romanesque churches at the same time. So, I know this episode has been running for quite some time already. It would be totally stupid to go into detail to all the big Romanesque churches, but I want to give you the quick tour, if I can. If this is too long for you, you can just pause the episode and listen to it another day, no problem. And this might be a good idea, why, I'll tell you later, but let's have a quick tour through the Romanesque churches. Around 1190, St. Andrew is rebuilt in the immediate vicinity of Cologne Cathedral. Since 1106, the monastery, through the incorporation of the suburb Niederich, is part of the walled city area. Around 1220, the new building is finished after only 30 years. Compared to other Romanesque churches, St. Andrew survived the destruction of World War II quite well. Visit the church when you are in Cologne. It's literally across the street from the cathedral, yet mostly completely free of tourist crowds. In the crypt there you can visit Albertus Magnus, final resting place, one of the greatest scholars of the Middle Ages. St. Apostles at the west end of Neumarkt Square dominates the square area to this day with a mighty crossing tower, equally mighty west tower and a cloverleaf choir. Once located directly in front of the western Roman city wall, it has also been part of the expanded walled city area since 1106. Here the reconstruction was already started around 1150. After a break, the reconstruction continued around 1200 and was completed around 1250. Here, however, the construction did not last 100 years, rather individual construction phases were underway with time intervals. St. Cecilia, seen at the opposite end of Neumarkt Square, was expanded by 1170 into the church we know to this day and now houses the Museum Schnütgen, the Museum of Medieval Art. Unfortunately, the extensive medieval paintings here were also lost, with the exception of a few fragments. Anno's foundation, the Collegiate Church of St. George, in the former southern suburb of Obersburg, which was incorporated into the walled city in 1106, received new vaulted ceilings around 1150. From 1180 to 1188, the mighty west tower was built, which dominates the church building to this day. St. George was badly damaged during the war, but the restoration made some compromises in interior design, but they recreated the big west tower as it had been in high medieval times and replaced the former Baroque tower design. St. Geryon had already been numerously expanded before 1150. The church with a late antique Roman core from the 4th century, yes, 4th century, isn't that great, was still outside the walled city area after 1106. Archbishop Anno had already had a new long choir built of the crypt around 1060. Between 1151 and 1156, the church was extended, as was the crypt below it. In the process, the choir was provided with wall paintings and mosaics, which have even been preserved in small fragments, one of the few examples where the Romanesque interior is still preserved. Feel free to ask the supervisor person there. She or he will be happy to show you where it is exactly located. St. Kunibert, once located directly on the Rhine in the northern suburb of Niederich near a fishing village, has been part of the walled city area since 1106. The church, once built here by Bishop Kunibert in the 7th century, was demolished and newly built between 1215 and 1247. A three-nave monastery church was built with a double-towered choir and a mighty west transept. Fortunately, remains of the wall paintings in the choir area have been preserved here as well in part. St. Mary in the capital, not far from today's Heumarkt Square in the former southeast corner of Roman Cologne, in the immediate vicinity also of the Ubian Monument, had already been built as a Romanesque church under Abbess Ida in the mid-11th century. It is standing on a former ancient Roman temple district. Here now the Christian building received new vaulted ceilings around 1240. In the late Middle Ages, and even longer beyond, St. Mary in the capital would be virtually the church of civic Cologne. New mayors were inaugurated here, and deserving personalities of the city received their funeral services here. I also now believe that, along with St. Geryon and St. Pantaleon, this Romanesque church, which is the final resting place for Ida and Plectrude, among others, is one of my favorite church buildings. But psht! Please don't tell the other Romanesque churches. No one should feel worse treated. We had already briefly touched on St. Mary Liskirchen. Around 1200, the eastern part of the church is rebuilt. When this was finished, the remaining older part in the west was torn down and new built as well. This resulted in a comparatively small three-nave basilica. The difference here is that, unlike the other large Romanesque churches, it was not built as a monastery church, but as a parish church. The whole thing was completed around 1250. It is the paintings from that period that can still be admired on a large scale in the parish church. The northern choir tower seems out of place and misplaced nowadays. Probably a southern counterpart was planned, but this was not realized. Or was the tower dilapidated in the late Middle Ages, or victim of a tragedy, or has it never been built? This is sadly not known. In the harbor district, the great St. Martin's Church, which later gave its name to the whole district, is being completely rebuilt from the rubble of the city fire of 1150. The floor level was raised by 1 meter. The free nave was again built on the foundation walls of the late antique Roman warehouse. By the way, you can visit it underground for a small fee during the opening hours of the church. Here they built comparatively long, about 100 years. Apparently there were stops and changes of plans in between. The new building was consecrated as early as 1172 already, but another fire in the building, this time in 1185, probably put a damper on the construction work. The crossing tower was now built square instead of octagonal as it had been planned before. It was therefore not until 1230 that the construction work was largely completed. The mighty silhouette of the crossing tower, which was extended again in the late Middle Ages, still dominates the city panorama of Cologne's old town today, which only Cologne Cathedral itself has been able to outshine since 1880, when Cologne Cathedral was finished. Unlike the other Romanesque churches in Cologne, Great St. Martin is still an active monastic church today. Or rather, it is once again, after an interruption of more than 200 years. Since 2009, so not really long ago, the basilica has been part of the convent of the Sisters and Brothers of Jerusalem. Let's take a look at St. Pantaleon. The former early medieval church on the site of a former Roman estate had already been rebuilt and expanded by Archbishop Bruno and his niece Empress Theophanu in the second half of the 11th century. Around 1106, it was still outside the already expanded city area in the southwest, in front of it, of the wall. In the meantime, a Benedictine abbey, the monastery church was extended by vaulted side aisles from 1170. The nave, however, remains with a flat wooden ceiling, until today. The former hall building is now completely surrounded by the mighty west work and the aforementioned side aisles. St. Pantaleon has preserved its quasi-rural character to this day, although today it is completely surrounded by the turbulent inner city. The surroundings of the former monastery are completely undeveloped on two sides and give the visitor the feeling of traveling back in time. At the time of this episode, St. Pantaleon is undergoing extensive restoration for several years and is closed. But I'm trying to find pictures I took there myself years ago. While the final resting place of Theophanu and Bruno is no longer a monastery, it is also not a normal parish church of the Archdiocese of Cologne. It has, since 1987, a parish church of Opus Dei, a conservative Catholic priestly and lay organization. Since it is my baptismal church, I have nothing to do with them, to clear that. No offense to Opus Dei, but it was mainly the historical significance and the enthusiasm for Theophanu that made my parents choose this church as a baptismal site. Saint Severin is a church about which we had also spoken far too little so far. We had briefly mentioned how it was once found as a late antique memorial building on a Roman cemetery in the south of the walled city and was further expanded in Frankish times in the early Middle Ages. Maybe we have to deal with it in more detail another time. The small hall church is located on the former Roman military road to Bonn and is named after one of the first known bishops of Cologne, namely Severin. Already expanded in Frankish times in the 6th century, but still of modest dimensions, it is once again expanded in Carolingian times, so the 9th century, and at an unknown time is the site of a monastery. Thus, St. Severin is mentioned as a monastery in the third place in that very document of transfer of property by Archbishop Gunther of the year 866, directly after the cathedral and St. Geryon. At the same time, St. Severin also served as a parish church. In 948, the new church was consecrated. It is now a three-nave church with a west work, typical for the architectural style of that time, like St. Pantaleon. Further extensions followed in the course of time until the great extension came in the years 1220 to 1237. The long choir is extended and vaulted. The choir received its two flanking towers, which were later extended again and still dominate the building today. Although I used to live there for a few years in the area, St. Severin is still comparatively too unknown to me. That was because at the time the church was also undergoing major restoration works. That is, it was often not really open for visit. I vow to do better. I mention the Church of St. Ursula as the last, not only because it comes alphabetically in the enumeration as the last of the Romanesque churches, but because it falls as a church building something from the series of this Romanesque Cologne century set from 1150 to 1250. Here a new building began to be erected as early as 1106 already. Directly in the same year of the city expansion, which included this suburban church in Niederrich, in the now further north and west newly excavated protective wall. Here someone was in a hurry, because directly with the excavation of those ramparts in order to be able to defend itself against Henry V, workers found something which was worth much more at that time than all gold of the world. But what that was, I will not spoil for you right now. In 1135, the new church building was completed. A three-nave church now stood here with galleries, eastern cross arms, and an imposing west building. Here in the convent, a new building had become necessary because the number of pilgrimage visitors had increased rapidly within a short time, and thus a larger church had become necessary. But more about this topic another time, promised. In general, the construction of new churches in that period was usually carried out according to the same pattern. First, the eastern part of the church was built, the holiest part of the church, called the choir. There were also west choirs, but that is another topic, let's leave that. The choir in the east was liturgically the most important area. Then was the turn of the transept in the middle. The crossing on top was not built until a central nave was in basic shape. The nave, consisting of the central aisle and the side aisles, as well as the west building or west wall, came afterwards to the end. Where did the building material come from? On site, stones from still Roman buildings, tombs or remains were reused on a really larger scale than one can see at first glance. Foreign stone material mostly came to Cologne via the Rhine River, since overland heavy transports were difficult, laborious, and above all expensive. Red sandstone was brought from the Moselle region and the Lahn region. Trachyte came from the Siebengebirge mountain area, directly south of Bonn. Guaiac was extracted from Bergisches Land mountain area east of Cologne. Black basalt was brought from north from the Eifel region to the city on the Rhine, and those who wanted to go fancy went to the former Roman waterline. Yes, that ancient Roman waterline, which once brought water to Cologne for over 90 kilometers in ancient times. Lime had been deposited there. Over the centuries, so much lime had gotten into it. And if you cut and polished it correctly, you had something that came very close to the expensive marble from Italy, from the looks, so to speak. Altars in particular were built with it. So that was a lot to take in. Let's take a short break and then try to find an end. That was my episode on the Romanesque century in Cologne from 1150 to 1250. The topic has not yet been exhausted, and we even forgot a very important Romanesque building, the largest Romanesque building ever. The medieval city wall, which was built starting in 1180 from scratch, totally new. But that's such a big topic, we'll have to discuss it another time. For a good overview of this art epoch, helped me the book with the simple title in German, Romanik, so Romanesque by Kunibert Behring. Then, of course, literature by Hiltrud Kier. It would be a serious mistake to leave out the former city conservator and expert in the field of Cologne's Romanesque churches. I can especially recommend her 2014 book, Die Romanischen Kirchen Kölns, Führer zur Geschichte und Ausstattung, meaning Cologne's Romanesque Churches, Guide to History and Furnishings, as an introduction. I learned all about that topic, how to build in the Middle Ages, from the book by art historian Günther Binding, who is an expert in the field of building in the Middle Ages. His book, Bauen im Mittelalter, so Building in the Middle Ages, gave me, as an architectural layman, a very simple and clear introduction to the subject. My last literature tip is meant seriously, even if it doesn't seem so at first glance. The book Romanik in Köln, Wie ging das? Or in English, Romanesque in Cologne, How does it work? Is aimed at a young audience and is written in very simple language and has many illustrations. Nevertheless, it is highly scientifically researched and written by a team of authors from the Förderverein Romanische Kirchen Köln, meaning association to preserve the Romanesque churches of Cologne. I am a member of it, by the way, as well. Even for a now over 30-year-old like me, this book was an ideal help for such a complex topic. I can only recommend it to you if you can read and read German. So, dear people, producing an episode every 3 weeks is exhausting. Therefore, many thanks to my Patreons who throw something into my head each episode. Thanks also to those who tipped me via PayPal. My sincere thanks go this time to Stefan, Hayo and Helga. I would like to address something. It is very exhausting for me to always publish a new episode every 3 weeks, as I just said. That's why I would like to take a little summer break, where I can lie in the sun for a while and recharge my batteries, especially my creativity, and where I not have to think about this podcast. It would do this podcast good, believe me. We have created so many hours of content with each other. Who misses me in these 6 weeks can always listen to the old episodes again, because surely after 60 episodes, more or less, you surely have some things maybe not quite in good memory anymore. Or you do the same, go out and switch down a gear. As far as this is possible for you, of course, if you have the time and money for that. So again, thank you for listening. Recommend me further and see you back, in August then, I believe. Auf Wiedersehen.